Well, welcome everybody. I'm really delighted that we have today Kim Campbell. As most of you will know, Kim Campbell was the Prime Minister of Canada and also the Defence Minister. She also is an LSE alum, and she's actually you're an honorary fellow of LSE. So we're really pleased to welcome her back to the LSE. But the main reason that we invited her and that I was keen to have her here is because she is the Secretary General of the Club of Madrid. Now, the Club of Madrid is a club of 140 former prime ministers and presidents. And over the past year, they've done a fascinating experiment, which was they decided to hold a meeting on the one-year anniversary of the Madrid bombing on the issue of democracy and terrorism. And I took part in the process, and I have to say it was a really fascinating, very productive process. And I think the Madrid agenda that came out of it is one of the best documents on how to deal with terrorism in all its aspects. So I'm really pleased that we have Kim here to present it to us. And I just wanted to say one more thing, which I just said before we came in. I think, you know, Kim, as Secretary General of the Madrid process, was a great role model for all of us. And there was a moment when she came with Mary Robinson, the Vice President of the Club of Madrid, to present what they were doing in London. And it was just great to see these two very impressive, articulate women presenting the Madrid agenda. And I think that was one of the reasons for its success. So now I'd like to give
you a big hand.
Thank you very much, Mary. I'm going to stand here at the podium and pretend that I actually have written notes here. I do have some. First of all, it's a delight to be here. As you heard, I was a student at the London School of Economics, and this is probably the only part that I would still recognize because so much has changed since the early 70s. I was a student of the late Leonard Shapiro, and I was a Soviet specialist, a student in Soviet government, which dates me. It was a very, very interesting time. And as soon as I had political retirement thrust upon me, courtesy of the Canadian electorate in 1993, one of the encouraging messages I received was from the London School of Economics that I had been elected to be an honorary fellow. And I was delighted, and I came. And the honorary fellow, it's one of the nicest honors you can have, because all you have to do is show up for dinner once a year in the summer. And a few years after I was named an honorary fellow, Mick Jagger was named an honorary fellow. And I could not come to the dinner, and I was absolutely beside myself. And then I heard that he didn't come either, so I felt a lot better. But it is really a delight to be here, and thank you very much for welcoming me. I'm actually sorry that you didn't put up my full title, the Right Honorable, for the simple reason that I actually spend a lot of time in the United States, where every time I'm introduced as the Right Honorable, they ask if there is a Left Honorable. And so it's sort of nice sometimes to be in a country where people don't ask that question. But anyway, I'm delighted to be here. What I'd like to do is, I know that some of you are Canadians and you may want to ask about other things. I am really here to be as stimulating and entertaining and time-consuming as possible. So I'd like to talk about the Club of Madrid and the Madrid agenda, but if in the question and answer session you want to ask me about other things, you're very welcome to. I'm very pleased to be here in whatever context or role is useful to you. The Club of Madrid is, I have to say, we are not 140. We're only 67, but you're thinking in advance. I hope someday we will be 140 presidents and prime ministers. It's a great number, and if you're like me, you pull numbers out of the air all the time. But in the fall of 2001, there was a conference held in Madrid on democratic transition and consolidation. And it was held there because a gentleman who was a fellow of the Gorbachev Foundation of North America, a Spaniard, wanted to take a program to his home country. And so we had this conference there, and it was a wonderful meeting. It brought together about 100 of the world's leading experts from about 22 countries, but it also brought 34 current and former heads of state and government. And what was interesting was the chemistry between the current and the former leaders. And that chemistry, where the formers were very comfortable talking very openly and reflectively about their experiences in government, and the very great interest of the current leaders in hearing some of these experiences, because, you know, there is no textbook about how to be a president or a prime minister. And very often, the kind of interesting experiences that leaders have don't make their way into the history books. So the current leaders were fascinated to, you know, draw out some of these experiences and ideas from the former leaders. And it was that chemistry that led us to feel that perhaps there was a role for an organization that could bring together former leaders to work on a peer relation basis with the leaders of transitional democracies. And out of that was created this Club of Madrid, which is in fact a club. It's just a voluntary organization of former presidents and prime ministers who elect new members. And you have to be, there's a couple of exceptions, but you have to be a former elected, either head of state or government, and not corrupt. So there are lots of people who are out of office who do not get a call from the Club of Madrid. There are a couple of exceptions to that rule in the sense that Mikhail Gorbachev is a member even though he was not democratically elected, but partly because his foundation was involved in the original conference, and also because of the role he played as a very important catalyst in a lot of issues, not simply in the former Soviet Union, but some of the decisions he made with respect to not using force to put down movements for democracy in Eastern Europe. He played an important role, so he is a member. Also, Jacques Delors, who has never been a head of government, is a member of the Club of Madrid. But the other members are all former heads of state and government. We do programs in different countries. Our members go. In fact, as we speak, we have Mary Robinson is in China. We've been having some very interesting conversations with the Chinese government. In fact, a former deputy premier and foreign minister, Chen Qichen, was at the Madrid summit in March. Very much liked it, went back to China. We heard that the Chinese were very positively impressed with that meeting. If we did another one, they would send a sitting vice premier, but also that they were interested in having conversations with members of the Club of Madrid. So I, with two other members, Petra Roman from Romania and Lee Hong-Koo from South Korea, did a series of meetings at the end of August when we happened to be in Beijing, and Mary Robinson is doing some meetings now. So we don't pretend that Club of Madrid is going to democratize China. We don't have a lot of hubris. But again, the Chinese are reaching out to have some interesting conversations, and we will see whether there is a constructive relationship where we may play a small role in perhaps providing at least some ideas of models that might be useful to them. Clearly, they know the status quo cannot be maintained, but at the moment, I think it would be naive to suggest that they are actively looking for ways to democratize. But so that's a longer proposal. Also, as we speak, one of our members, Valdis Burkovs, who's one of our new members, former Prime Minister of Latvia, is in Kiev, where there is a meeting sponsored by the President of the Ukraine and the President of Georgia at a new gathering called the Community of Democracies of Choice, where they are looking to see, looking for advice and processes to try and smooth democratic transitions in what the area they call the three seas between the Baltic, the Black Sea, and the Caspian. I'm not sure what will come out of that. Our member is there really on kind of a survey mission to see what might come out. But again, it's an interesting example. Sorry, I'm kind of... No, that's a light. I feel a bit antisocial, the people who are sitting down there, but... But what is interesting is that, again, the mixture of experience of our members, that for the Georgians and the Ukrainians, they're very interested in having a former prime minister of Latvia who actually led the transition in Latvia, led their country out of the Soviet Union, because his experience is relevant to their own situation. So different members have different backgrounds and different experiences that are useful in different parts of the world. Also, as we speak, one of our members, Antonio Mascarenhas Montero, the former president of Cape Verde, a small African country, is probably still on his way, since it's going to take him forever to get there, to East Timor to be part of a conference at the request of the Prime Minister's office, where they have asked us for some help. So these are kind of survey missions to see what we can do. But it gives you some idea that our members around the world, they're working in Bolivia, they're working in Ecuador, and other parts of the world. But in March of this year, to mark the anniversary of the Madrid bombings, we convened a conversation in Madrid that was really an example of another advantage that the Club of Madrid has, and that was our power to convene. And again, when we put this group together, we didn't really know all of the things that we would be able to do. You bring them together, and people ask you to do things, and some things you can do, and some things you can't. But what we discovered quite early on was that when we invited people to come to meetings, to do things, they would come. When you get a letter from Fernando Henrique Cardoso, the former president of Brazil, and you see Mary Robinson as the vice president, Bill Clinton's the honorary co-chair, people think, something must be happening here. Maybe I will go. And so when we decided to convene the Madrid summit, we did so with not a lot of lead time, and probably only lunatics would do this, because by definition, we had less than a year to do it. We began to think about it in the late spring of 2004, and the details really started to crystallize in the summer. We were very generously supported by the three levels of government in Spain and the government of Norway, who altogether put together a fund of about 4.4 million euros. It's a lot of money. But what was interesting is that the government of Spain could never have convened this meeting. It would have been seen as much too political. So what was interesting about the Club of Madrid's role is that we're global, we're independent, but we also have the stature that people will come if we invite them. We had a very excellent director of content, Dr. Peter Newman, who was at that time at King's College, another London-based scholar, who brought together a group of experts, including Mary Calder, and I'll ask her in a minute, maybe she'll say a little bit about some of her own experience of being involved. But people were asked to bring together into 16 working groups, 30 of the best scholars, the best thinkers, or practitioners, people who would have something to add to the particular area of the issue of terrorism and its relationship to democracy that they could. What was so important about this was the independence of the process. Again, because we are formers, we're not in office. We don't represent our countries. We only represent our experience. And we are also global. So we have no axe to grind. We have no agenda. There's no desired outcome. We weren't there to beat up on the Americans. We weren't there to vindicate the Americans. We were there to find out what kind of thinking do you get when you bring together the best people from around the world, and they were from over 50 countries, to deliberate on the various issues about the way democracy intersects with the need to confront terrorism. And there were two particular aspects. And again, the Club of Madrid is interested in democracy. That's our goal is to promote democratic transition. So we said two things motivate this search. One, what can democracies do in partnership? What are the ways in which democracies have advantages in working with one another? That rule of law speaks to rule of law. Can democracies collaborate more? How can they take advantage of the rules that they share in order to deal more effectively with the threat of something like terrorism? Because we know that terrorism can take advantage of the openness of democratic societies, but then how can democracies use their own particular advantages to strengthen their security? On the other side of the coin is, how can you struggle against terrorism without eroding democratic rights? Because terrorism frightens people. It creates uncertainty, and we've seen this particularly in the United States, where there's even been an enormous dampening down of criticism of the government. I am an American resident, and it's really kind of frightening to see this, that people are very, and because they are genuinely afraid, and afraid that if they are critical, that somehow this gives aid and comfort to the enemy. And it's not the only time. I mean, there's many occasions, and not just in the United States, in my own country, in your country, when people are afraid, they are very often complicit in the erosion of their own rights. How can we make sure that democratic governments do what their obligation is to try and keep their people as safe as possible without eroding the very rights that characterize democracy in the first place? So those were the kind of surrounding values that we had that led us to convene this conversation. Our working groups worked together over a four-month period prior to the meeting in Madrid. They came together in Madrid and deliberated face-to-face very intensively for a day and a half. And then we convened another series of 20 panels of experts and expert practitioners who'd come in from around the world, very high-level panels. And it was interesting because part of the problem that we underestimated our power to convene was that we had written to a whole lot of very high-powered people and said, we're having this summit, and we would like you to come and to play an important role, which they all thought meant, keynote speech. Then we discovered we had way too many people who were going to come. And if they were all going to give keynote speeches, we were going to be there for weeks, and probably attention spans would lag. So we had a great deal of delicate footwork to do to convince very high-level people that they were now going to be on high-level panels with other equally distinguished people. And there were some people for whom it was a little bit difficult, but eventually they did. And in fact, those panels were wonderful. Having one very distinguished person give a speech is great, but having a series of very distinguished people having a dialogue and a discussion from a perspective of being very informed and very engaged is even more exciting. So those panels were really quite remarkable. the results of the deliberations were fed into a drafting committee made up of members of the Club of Madrid. And it was interesting that we had a group of our scholars and non-members who had been agreeing to help. But what was interesting to me was the eagerness of our members actually to engage in writing the Madrid agenda. And there you see Lionel Jospin and Sadiq Almadi and Antonio Guterres, all these people, you know, arguing over, you know, how exactly to express things. But it was wonderful because it meant the members really took ownership of the Madrid agenda, that it really does belong to them. Let me very, very quickly talk about what the Madrid agenda says and what it does. But again, when the working groups were meeting in January, they came to Madrid for an early meeting, the leader said to me, "Do you want us to push for consensus?" And I said, "No, we don't want you to push for consensus. The goal of the Club of Madrid, when we do deliberative processes, you know, we're not a think tank, we're an action tank. So when we do deliberative processes, we want recommendations that are useful to policymakers. What can people take and act on? Not simply say, well, this is a nice idea, and on the one hand, the other hand. So, but people have to make policy in the real world. So if you push people and twist their arms and pretend that there was a consensus in your working group on an issue when there isn't really, when in fact informed people are divided on an issue, you don't help those who are trying to make public policy in the real world. On the other hand, if there is, as a result of this very free and open discussion among highly informed people, agreement, if there is a consensus, it's more powerful. And therefore, it has value, and it's worth saying there was a broad consensus on this particular dynamic, and you can rely upon it. So there was no effort to push for a consensus. But interestingly enough, there were some very interesting areas of consensus. And one of the very interesting areas of consensus was that terrorism is a phenomenon that has to be confronted on a multilateral basis within the confines of the rule of law and respect for human rights. And what was interesting was that this was a principle that came out from a variety of different perspectives. It's all sort of like the old story about, you know, the blind man describing the elephant depends on which, you know, appendage they're hanging on to, how they describe the animal. But similarly, people approach the issue of terrorism from many different perspectives, whether you're a psychologist and a psychiatrist looking at the psychological profiles of people who commit terrorist acts, whether you are looking at religious factors, whether you're looking at the way civil society is organized, you're looking at international legal issues, military issues, intelligence issues, policing issues. But this broad array of experts and expert groups all agreed on the importance of the rule of law and respect for human rights, for both moral and practical reasons. Now, I don't think any of this that I'm going to tell you is going to be surprising. You're not going to say, my goodness, isn't this amazing? I've never heard that idea before. But what is important is that this was a consensus that was freely arrived at in one of the most open conversations and well-informed conversations that's been had. And I think it's important to know that even our most hard-nosed military types, our confronting terrorism subject area was led by Ray Kendall, who was a 3-time Secretary General of Interpol. These were people who were used to dealing with the practical problems of security. These were not people who were living, and I hate to say this, in an ivory tower, but who were living in an ivory tower, which is the way people often like to dismiss the views of people who are not actually out there with helmets on. The fact of the matter is scholars have enormously important perspectives because, for one thing, they have the leisure and the resources to do the kind of deep thinking that you don't get a chance to do when you're, in fact, in public life, I can assure you. But the point is that there you can't criticize and say, oh, well, these are a bunch of people who are kind of divorced from reality. Au contraire, the deputy commissioner of the New York Police Department responsible for counterterrorism was one of the experts who was engaged in this process. So these were people who were very hands-on. So the fact that they came up with that consensus, I think, was important. There was also the importance of effective global international cooperation. And again, the notion that terrorism has also many sources and many causes. One of the interesting insights that came out of the discussion is something that sometimes flies in the face of conventional wisdom, which is that poverty is not, people say, well, what causes terrorism? Well, poverty. Well, poverty is a terrible thing. And there are a gazillion reasons why poverty is a blight and a disruptive thing to the world, not just a negative thing for people who suffer from it. But it is not simply defined a cause of terrorism or even necessarily a significant factor. It may exacerbate a sense of marginalism. much more important, the scholars found and the practitioners found, were the disruptions in the sense of dislocation that comes from rapid social and political change. That this may or may not be accompanied by economic dispossession or economic uncertainty, but it's much more the challenge of societies in dealing with the threats to often to traditional belief systems, the threats to a sense of security, the threat to a sense of predictability in a society that come from rapid social and political change that can throw things up in the air and lead people to look for people to attack, people to blame, and people against whom to vent their aggression. The Madrid Agenda is a complex document, and I don't want to get into trying to talk about all of it. Let me say first of all that it is on the website, which is just clubmadrid.org, not even off, just clubmadrid.org. The working papers are also on the website, and we will have a three-volume series of the research papers that went into the working papers that is being published. The first volume is getting ready to go to press. Rutledge is publishing it. So for all of the recommendations, there is a kind of pyramid of scholarly and working group deliberation that goes into supporting it. Let me talk about a couple of things that came out of the Madrid Agenda that I thought were kind of interesting. First of all, there was a very great, strong emphasis on the fact that terrorism requires a whole variety of approaches, but a very clear support for the use of military action where it is necessary. I mean, this was a very clear-eyed recognition that sometimes military action is appropriate, but when it is appropriate, it must be done within the context of the rule of law. But that there's a kind of an idea of subsidiarity. That given the nature of terrorism, it's really important that it has to be confronted from the bottom up. So there were two strong emphases. One on how do you empower law enforcement? How do you focus on local communities? And there were a great deal of recommendations about how to address the kinds of tensions and estrangement that happen at the local level. How do you strengthen the capacity of law enforcement at the local level to recognize when there are problems that are brewing, to recognize the signs of what might lead to terrorist acts? And this is something that I know people in Britain have been talking about a great deal. But there was also a concern to try and empower countries that are not developed with the capacity to engage in that kind of sophisticated grassroots level law enforcement and monitoring. We have fairly sophisticated systems in our own country. I mean, I think of the UK, and you have monitoring cameras that enables you to see the train bombers as they were coming into their railway stations, etc. But many countries really do not have that capacity. So when we're looking at how we support other countries in confronting terrorism, that grassroots level capacity is extremely important. Issues in looking at how people are radicalized, strategies not only for understanding how people are radicalized, but also for understanding how you help people get out of the engagements that they sometimes get into when they get involved with radical groups. That sometimes people get involved in these groups and they don't know how to get out. And there are some really interesting insights into how those approaches can be made that can make it possible for people who want to move on, who are unhappy with where they are. Jessica Stern from Harvard has actually done some very interesting work in that when she's worked with a lot of right-wing radical groups even in the United States, and how people get caught up but often don't know how to get out of these situations. So the scholarship and the recommendations look very much at that level right at the ground bottom-up level of how you address the real causes of terrorism and the dynamics that can perhaps interrupt it. The importance, of course, of internationally of streamlining and harmonizing international laws is very important. Laws, for example, dealing with extradition, these are issues that always can get in the way, and they can also lead to some very interesting conflicts between countries. There were also attention paid to the whole issue of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Again, we sometimes forget that these issues are also directly related to the terrorist threat as well. Internationally, there were a variety of recommendations, some of them dealing with the preconditions to creating an international convention on terrorism. But again, if that is going to be difficult to achieve, we cannot focus on simply, you know, trying to get the Convention Against Terrorism, trying to get the UN to agree on a definition of terrorism. Countries have to work on bilateral and regional security arrangements. They cannot wait for some kind of global context. And sometimes those regional arrangements can expand into a more globalized view. Just two other points I want to make quickly, because it's a very detailed document, but in terms of the relationship between democracy and terrorism, there was a conclusion that ultimately democracy was probably the best antidote to the development of terrorism. It's not a cure-all. Terrorism happens in democratic societies, as we have seen. But in terms of allowing people outlets for their grievances, the development of real democracies, thriving democracies, meaningful democracies, is probably the best strategy that we can have. And when we talk about marginalization can happen within democracies, which is why democracies have to look at the accessibility of democratic rights, participation in democratic institutions by all people, and not take for granted the fact that they have these institutions, that all people see them or feel well served by them. We also looked at the question of victims of terrorism as well, and there was a recommendation for the creation of high commissioners for victims, both at the international and national level, who will represent the victim's right to know the truth, as well as to obtain justice, adequate redress, and integral reparation. Let me just quickly say, I want to ask Mary to make a comment, but I want to say, closing the circle, and I hope I'm not being too terse in this, there were many, many recommendations. But one of the other advantages that the Club of Madrid has is that because of who its members are, we are able to take the results of this deliberation and feed it back into policy-making processes. So right after the Madrid summit, we were at the ministerial meeting of the Community of Democracies in Santiago, where the Madrid agenda was widely discussed. It's been widely discussed within the context of the European Union. Some of our experts were asked to go and meet with European Parliament rapporteurs who were drafting resolutions for the European Parliament. The coordinator for anti-terrorism of the European Commission has been looking at the Madrid agenda, was very interested in our recommendation to create an international center for terrorist financing. Again, it's different from the kinds of work that we do. I was justice minister in Canada. We did a lot of work on money laundering, but much of the money that goes to fund terrorist activities is perfectly legitimate money. It's the purpose to which it is put that is illegitimate, not necessarily the source. But we know that by tracing money, we can often find the people who are engaged in these activities and begin to trace the networks. So the document is also in the UN system. We had a follow-up conference in Washington in September to try and Americanize the Madrid agenda. Americans are not likely to adopt something called the Madrid agenda. It's a more parochial system. But we had an excellent meeting in Washington that was bipartisan. We had good American involvement, but there is a certain sensitivity in the American administration. The Attorney General, Mr. Gonzalez, actually came to Madrid, but he came and sort of gave a speech and then left. But we've been trying to inject the Madrid agenda into the debate. An article in the New York Review of Books said that the Madrid agenda and the documents, the working papers that had come out of the Madrid summit, were extremely welcome, and that it represented a conversation that should have taken place in the United States after 9/11. So, and others have said that the process has injected some excellent new intellectual capital into the debate. So I think what's interesting about it is that it is a process whereby people who are powerless, people who are out of office, could nonetheless use the cachet and the stature of the offices they used to hold, combined with their current independence, to convene a conversation where some of the most knowledgeable people in the world could deliberate without any pressure to come to a predetermined conclusion, but also to meet one another and continue the conversation, and know that the results of their work would then be given the broadest currency by this group of people who had convened them. And I hope that the Club of Madrid will be able to continue to convene these kinds of conversations on issues relating to threats to democracy that are difficult for governments to deal with. One of the issues that I'd like us to talk about is democracy and drugs. I mean, that's a hugely interesting and troublesome issue, and even some of our members go, ooh, when I mention it. But there are some subjects which are difficult because governments have political positions and agendas that they need to respect. I want to just ask Mary Calder to say something about her own experience, because one of the other aspects of this process was our ability to bring together people who might not otherwise ever have been invited to participate in such a process by giving full freedom and autonomy to those experts whom we'd asked to give us their expertise, but also people who have continued to be in touch. And I think that there is a resonance from the Madrid summit that continues and will continue long after we've finished our own work on it. So I'd like to ask Mary Calder to say a few words, and then I will take my seat, and then I'm just delighted to respond to any questions, comments that you may have about this or any other issue, and I'll take my seat so I can see the people who are hidden behind there, and I hope you're not making faces at me.
To tell you about a couple of things, because I think it was a great experience being part of this. My job was to convene the civil society working groups, and actually there were two parallel civil society things happening. Throughout the process, the Club of Madrid actually engaged the website Open Democracy to try to engage people all over the world through the web in the process. And actually, in parallel to the actual meeting in Madrid, there were a whole series, how many were there, Chloe, of meetings? There were about 150. Chloe here was actually organizing that. And so alongside what was formerly happening in Madrid, there were about 150 meetings simultaneously in different parts of the world, discussing the same issues, and there was an online debate which Chloe was responsible for organizing. So that was another very sort of interesting, innovative aspect of the process. But my job was to convene the civil society working groups, which was actually a fantastic opportunity, because if any of you have ever been engaged in civil society work, you know that you never have enough money to invite people from difficult situations. And in this case, I did. So I could invite civil society activists from Iraq, from Kashmir, from the Philippines, all people. We had families of 9/11, civil society groups who had organized around terrorism in their situations. And of course, not all of them came. It was actually very, very difficult to organize in the short time we had. The person from Kashmir couldn't get a passport, for example. So we had lots of problems. We had a Palestinian, we had an Israeli activist. So we had a really interesting group. We had actually three working groups dealing with different aspects of the problem. But we had a really fascinating and intense discussion. And I just want to say a couple of things. One, about what came out of it. What we agreed and what we put into the Madrid agenda, and secondly, about what's happened as a result of follow-up. I think what we want to get onto the Madrid agenda is that dealing with terrorism is not just a matter for states, it's a matter for citizens as well. And citizens are not just victims of terrorism, they're also agents. And so to get a sense that this isn't something that you're powerless. And that was something that came into the final agenda. We developed a set of principles about what the civil society working groups thought about the problem. One was that, unfortunately, I don't have all the papers in front of me, so I can't tell you exactly everything. But one was that terrorism is a global phenomenon. There's a tendency for us in the West to think of terrorism as something against us. But actually, people in the Middle East and Asia have experienced much more terrorism than people in New York, Madrid, and London. The second was this point that citizens have to be agents and not just passive victims. The third was the point that terrorism tends to flourish, or rather terrorists tend to flourish, in areas, and by terrorism we meant this was the third point, was that terrorism, it can be undertaken both by state and non-state actors, which is something that was not in the final definition, but it was something the civil society groups thought was important to emphasize, that terrorism can be inflicted by regular forces when they inflict violence against civilians as much as by terrorists. So that was one of the principles that came out of the civil society working groups. The third was that situations where terrorism is particularly bad tend to be either authoritarian states or failing states. And this is why democracy is such an important, has such an important role to play in countering terrorism. I think those are the main... Oh, and the final principle was that actually the reaction of the Spanish people to the Madrid bombings on March the 11th and the way they dealt with it in Madrid did represent a model for how you should deal with things in the future. So those were the principles, and we specifically proposed the idea that there should be, parallel to what is done by governments, a kind of network of citizens thinking about what to do about terrorism and campaigning against terrorism in all its forms. And that's something that Chloe, who's sitting there, is now working on. And we are going to go ahead and have a meeting, I think probably in February, to talk about how to take this the next step. What's been fascinating to us is that we found the most support for this idea to come out of the Middle East. Both people in Cairo and people in Istanbul have offered to be the headquarters for this network because they feel very strongly that Islam in particular has been identified with terrorism and has been discredited as a result. So they're very keen to have such a campaign in their societies, and that's one of the most interesting things, I think, that came out of it. The other thing I wanted to say was that the process, as Kim said, was a very exciting and engaging process, and lots of sort of unexpected spin-offs happened as a result of it, as a result of the people we invited and the people we met. And I just wanted to give you one example, which is that we invited a leader of the women's movement in Iraq to come. And we also invited a Sunni Muslim cleric from Iraq. And you would think that these two people could not be more far removed. But actually, they flew together. And they had lots and lots of difficulties, which I won't go into. But as a result, they became great friends. And now they're really working together inside Iraq to prevent sectarian conflict. And so that's a really nice and significant outcome that wasn't planned at all. So now I'll hand you over to ask Kim more questions.
Hello. I'm sorry,
May I suggest that, yeah. I'm sure you all know each other, but maybe you can just introduce yourself.
No, yeah, well, I don't think anybody knows me here. My name is Kiko, and I am not a politician, neither academic. I am an ordinary person, and I come from the Basque Country. And I have to start by being critical. And it's not that I don't like to see democracy extending over the world, and I completely agree that democracy is the solution for terrorism. The problem is I, as a Basque ordinary person, I'm growing up to be skeptical of politicians, and I don't think that the Madrid agenda can do anything, and I've got three main reasons for that. First is on the definition of terrorism. As you probably know, there was state terrorism in Madrid, but there is state terrorism in so many other places in the world. You said that there are no corrupt politicians in the group, and also you said that there are no interests in them. Well, I don't think so. If you look at the executive committee in the Club of Madrid, you'll find people like Ernesto Zedillo or Cesar Gaviria, and all of them have internal problems in their countries. I don't think they have a very clean record either. And I think they have a very strong interest in using the Madrid agenda and the internationalization and international cooperation to cover up the lack of a democracy and civil rights in their own countries. I think it's a very strong example in Spain, where I come from, and I know very well the past case. And every time I hear about Madrid and Madrid agenda, for me it is bad news. It is bad news because every time they talk about internationalization of conflict, what we get at home is a worsening of the problem. An example is under the current system, the Spanish government is denying any international involvement to solve and find a negotiated solution to the problem in Basque Country. We are seeing people like Marcelo Otamendi, the editor of a Basque newspaper, who was arrested and tortured. We're seeing people like Luis Maria Chirinac, a historical civil rights campaigner, who is being arrested under charges of terrorism. I think the Madrid agenda can be used by many governments to cover up by the lack of legitimacy and democracy in the way they are dealing with internal conflicts. And I will ask you to do all your best to stop this from happening. Thank you.
Well, I'm unaware of the issues you're talking about, but I don't see where the Madrid agenda plays into it at all. The principles of the Madrid agenda certainly don't support any of the activities that you're talking about. And in terms of our members, you know, I don't know if there's any politician in the world that you could find for whom there isn't any criticism. And in fact, the government of Canada, happily not one that I'm part of, has just been in a big corruption scandal. So it's not that there are never any difficulties anywhere. I think our members are pretty clean. If they're not, then you know they'll wind up withdrawing from the organization. But I think what's important is that, you know, in terms of the Madrid agenda, and Mary spoke about one issue that the civil society groups mentioned that did not turn up on the agenda with respect to the definition of terrorism. We recommended accepting the definition in the high-level panel, which does not include state terrorism, but makes very clear that violence by the state against civilians is already against the law, against international law. It is not condoned. Not calling it terrorism is a semantic question. And that if it gets in the way of coming up with some kind of definition that could enable us to move on to an international convention, then we should move beyond that. And that was the recommendation that the Club of Madrid agreed, that the high-level panel's definition should go ahead, which is not for a nanosecond a condoning of state violence. On the contrary, say, what do we call it? And if there's already clear international conventions, norms against it, then insisting on including it in the definition of terrorism isn't necessarily very helpful if it gets in the way of that kind of an international scope. But I think, you know, the Madrid agenda, I mean, the whole point of the members of Club Madrid is we are not in government. You know, we don't have the power to solve that problem in Spain. What we do have the power is to bring together people and let them deliberate in a way that's very free and open and add to the debate. And I like the expression that somebody used to say that the Madrid agenda has injected some very interesting new intellectual capital into the debate. It's not the last word. And I don't for a second suggest it is. But when people look at the recommendations, they can also see an enormously rich discussion and highly informed discussion that was created by people who were not chosen by the members. You know, we didn't choose, I didn't choose Mary Calder. Our academic coordinator chose Mary Calder and chose all of the other people who were the coordinators. Who were not chosen for political reasons, but chosen for reasons of their expertise. And I think that's important. I don't want to make it any suggestion that I'm somehow overstating that somehow the Madrid agenda is here and, you know, no more worries, folks, we've solved the problem. What it is, as I always say about the Club of Madrid, that we're a tile in the mosaic. And I hope the Madrid agenda is a tile in a mosaic of a conversation a set of understandings which will help us to deal with a frightening challenge to many people that was often gets in the way of both collaboration and protection of our rights and liberties. And that's the most one can hope from anything, I think, in this context.
Should we take two or three at a time?
Sure. Mr.
Yeah. Why don't we come to the front here?
Ms. Campbell, welcome back to the LSE. Can I ask, when you were sitting in the audience like we are now, whether you ever envisioned achieving what you have and perhaps how you've gotten to where you are? And then secondly, as a follow-up, your current independence, do you place more value in that as opposed to the augmented rostrum where you were minister or prime minister of Canada? Like, I mean, do you value your independence that you currently have over the automatic audience that you had previously?
Why don't we ask a few questions?
I'm very happy to see you tonight. Huh? Very happy to see you to come tonight. Thank you. I little bit wonder about how to make peace and how to respond to terrorism in today, because we need to respect other people, other country difference. A very big organization of the head of state, they are very good before, yeah, but they got good idea. But sometimes they may not understand other country, other people difference, and sometimes we need to build the friendship first, more than to build the law. We have many international law, many years, many theory, idea, but we need friendship and to respect the difference sometime. This is my idea, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell, for your input. I'm curious to know whether there's been a conscious, stated a concept of leadership within the Madrid Club, and how does that differ to being in a leadership position with a certain kind of power when you're in office?
I forgot to remind you all to say your names, but never mind. I think we could answer those and then take some more,
sure.
Don't you?
First of all, when I sat here, no, I did not envision. But there were very interesting people who came through in those days. People like Isaiah Berlin, and Michael Oakeshott giving his lecture here when he took on the chair of political philosophy. It was a very exciting time. But it's interesting, I don't come from a political family. When I was a teenager, I wanted to be the first woman Secretary General of the UN. So I clearly had desires to do something breakthrough for women. But I didn't. Politics was not something that I thought about, but I enjoyed it very much. And it's interesting, I think, when I look back at my time at the LSE, so much of what you learn when you're at school is not what you learn in the classroom. And even the days when I taught, I used to say to my students, you'll forget 90% of what you learn here, unless you go on in this particular field. But you learn to think. To think critically, you learn to express yourself, you learn to do research, to construct an argument, and it's a kind of a training for your brain. And what I found at the LSE was that it was coming and living in a different country, meeting a whole lot of different people, a different social structure in Britain compared to Canada. The LSE was very international in my day, so whenever something was happening in the world, some group of the student body was up in arms doing something.
Same here, same now.
And I'm sure it still is, and that's one of the great values of it. So I learned an enormous amount from the other students, and it was great. So I don't blame the LSE for any of my obvious faults, but it may have prevented them from getting worse. Is it better to be independent? No, power is better. Quite seriously, and I say this to people, and I say this often when I'm talking to women about getting, you know, women go, ooh, power, ooh, ooh. Power exists, and somebody is going to have it. And it may as well be you if you have any interest in using it for public good. And I am very comfortable with my time in office. I know that I spent 3 years as Minister of Justice and Attorney General in Canada. And my former staffers tell me that those years are still regarded as the golden years when the Department of Justice operated in the national interest. And I am proud of that. And it is wonderful to have power. It is wonderful to be able to make decisions. People say, what do you miss about politics? I miss making real decisions. I don't miss being hassled by the press. I don't miss all the other difficult things. But it was wonderful. And if any of you have any desire to engage in public service and engage in elected office, I strongly encourage you to do it. The worst thing that can happen in a democracy is for people to be cynical about the democratic process. Democracies are imperfect.
You know, everybody quotes Churchill till they're blue in the face, but they quote him because he was right. It's the worst system of government except for all the others. And the thing that kills it, the thing that kills it, is for people to say it doesn't matter. But there are many different ways of making a democracy work. Creating a vibrant civil society is certainly one of them. Vibrant political parties are extremely important. People sometimes think, ooh, parties, you know, the American Republic was formed on the basis that political parties were sort of nasty things that they didn't want to import from Britain. And they soon realized you can't make the institutions function without parties. They are ways of organizing choice for voters. So all of these things are very important. And I served at all three levels of government in Canada. I had elected office at local, provincial, and federal level. And I loved every minute of it. There was the odd minute I would compress into a nanosecond and blot out of my memory if I could, particularly the ones that involved me with both feet in my mouth. But it was great. But lots of good people get defeated, which is very important to remind yourself when you win an election, that lots of good people get defeated and a lot of turkeys get elected. And there is no tenure in politics. And so when you no longer have the power of your office, then you say to yourself, now what? And what I did was I said, what were the values that took me into public office in the first place? I care a lot about the advancement of women. And because I'd been a Soviet special, I think I had a particular perspective on democracy. In fact, when I was a graduate student here at the LSE, I spent 3 months traveling by myself in the Soviet Union. And I remember Professor Shapiro, I'm sorry he's not still alive, he was the most wonderful man. I was actually president of the LSE Music Society.
Gosh.
And sang in the choir. and he used to come to all our concerts. And when he heard my plan to go to the Soviet, he said, oh, clever girl, he said. You know, he didn't sort of say, are you nuts? Anyway, but I traveled for 3 months in a country which was not democratic, and people took me home, and I saw lots of things, and it made me understand how important democracy is. So I care about it, and it isn't perfect, and the Club of Madrid is not perfect. We are mere mortals, but we have some stature, we have some political capital that we can use, we have some experience. So you say, well, how can I use that to promote the causes that took me into public life in the first place? And sometimes even just showing that you're a survivor. You know, I became leader of our party when we were at historically low levels of support. My predecessor was the most unpopular prime minister in the history of Canadian polling. And we have a parliamentary system like you have here in Britain, you know, maximum 5-year mandate. 4.5 years into our mandate, he announced he was going to step down and that 4 months hence there would be a leadership convention. This did not leave his successor, whoever he or she might be, a lot of time to turn the party fortunes around. So, if you know, timing is everything in, you know, lovemaking and politics. And you have more control of it when you're horizontal, believe me. And anyway, so the point was it was not all that easy an experience. But I really do think that there are many different ways to make a difference. And if you have the opportunity to hold public office and be able to make decisions, and you have a deep moral responsibility to do it as well as possible, which means remembering politics is not an abstract exercise. Real flesh and blood human beings are going to have to live with the results of your decision. Talk to them. Find out from them what the impact of your decisions will be, and maybe they'll keep you from doing some really dumb things, as I learned. I learned a lot from the people who are going to be affected. So power is better, but if you don't have it, find other ways of using what you know and what you've experienced and surviving. Showing that there is life after politics is also an important lesson of democracy. There are worse things in the world than losing an election. You know, being blown up. You know, not having democratic choices. You know, having terrible poverty. Not being able to learn to use your mind. These are tragedies. What I experienced was a misfortune of losing an election. It wasn't a tragedy. And so again, that lesson of survivorship is important also. So, that's a long answer to a short question. Having to understand other countries is very important, and in fact, one of the reasons that the Club of Madrid is global, and we don't, there's some countries that produce lots of former leaders, my own country being one of them. But we try to reach out and find countries around the world that can enrich our experience. Unfortunately, there are not a lot. There aren't any Arab democracies, although the Sudan did have some democratic periods. So a former prime minister of Sudan is one of our members. Yemen is kind of hanging by its fingernails into the Club of Democracies. But their former prime minister, Al-Riani, is really, I think, a force for progress. And so we try to reach out to make our understanding of the world as rich as it possibly can be, so that we don't fall into the trap of putting our heads on other people's shoulders, which is another one of my maxims I give you for free. That very often, you know, I say this often in the context of fighting for women's rights, that, you know, we often want people not only to do what we want them to do, but to do it for the reasons that we would do it. And sometimes you just have to make people do things for pragmatic reasons. The truth, beauty, and justice of it will occur to them later. So don't put your head on other people's shoulders, and try as much as possible as you can to understand other people's reality. It's always an imperfect process, but you're absolutely right. And that is why it's interesting in supporting democratic processes. And I like the expression, which doesn't translate well, but thank goodness we all speak English here, that democracy cannot be imported or exported, but it must be supported. And I think the important thing is to understand that there are many different ways in which democratic relationships can be created, of accountable governing structures with the rule of law, where people choose who will make the rules of the game. And we mustn't, you know, impose our own institutions necessarily on others, but there are certain universal principles that are non-negotiable. And finally, the question of is there a standard or stated view concept of leadership? I taught for 3 years at the Kennedy School in the Center for Public Leadership, and there was a great deal of navel gazing there as to whether leadership was even a discipline that you could teach. And certain people who'd been teaching it for a long time occasionally wanted to throw themselves out of a basement window when people said that their whole life's work had been a waste of time because you couldn't really teach leadership or study it or talk about it. We don't have a concept of, well, I thought I was talking about leading after leaving, that in that sense we talk about how you share what you know and you do it in a very non-didactic way. You do it in a way of offering up to people your insights or what you did in your own countries, the kinds of things that maybe worked. For example, when President Paniagua of Peru goes into Bolivia to talk about the process that he led in his own country of creating a constituent assembly to move them out of a political crisis towards restoration of democracy. These are ideas and experiences that can be shared. But one of my colleagues at the Kennedy School, Marty Linsky, used to say that in fact leadership is a very rare thing, because most people don't choose leaders to lead. They don't really want them to lead. What they want them to do is to exercise authority within a very carefully defined circle. And he said that real leadership consisted of the capacity to convince your followers to accept loss. In other words, if you're ever going to move and make a change, somebody's ox is going to get gored. And the great leaders are the people who can lead people and persuade the losers in the process to accept their loss in order to enable the society or the organization, whatever they're leading, to move to a new area. So real leadership is very difficult. Sometimes people don't get an opportunity to do a lot of real leadership if they lead in sort of quiet times. Some people thought that, you know, Bill Clinton had 9/11 envy, that, you know, I mean, there was this, you know, defining moment for a leader. I'll leave it to history to decide whether a leader was defined by it. But, you know, so sometimes you get opportunities to really, and Harry Truman said that, you know, leaders are not born, they're made, certain circumstances get thrust upon them. So leadership is one of those kind of inchoate, indefinable concepts. We think we know it when we see it. But I think all of us are capable of doing it, and we often find ourselves leading in contexts that we never really thought we could. But, you know, every time you find yourself being able to persuade people of something and accepting and persuading them to accept the loss of something or a sacrifice in order to accomplish something bigger, that's leadership. And however you can do it, it is much to be desired. And many of us who've had formal leadership positions, you know, are full of criticism of our own activities. Our members, they do not have hubris. We don't walk around saying, oh, you lucky people, the Club of Madrid, here we are to help you. On the contrary, we say, in all modesty, if what we have done and what we've learned even from our own mistakes can be helpful to somebody who is dealing with the problems in their own society, then it is a labor of love for us to be able to share it in the hopes that, that others can benefit from what we have sometimes painfully learned.
Okay. I'm going to take a few from this. I've not forgotten you, but I'll take a few from over here.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned using force for terrorism. How about prevention? Did you speak about prevention, such as integration in society for foreigners or even local people?
And then the person behind there, and then you're next, right over at the back.
Yeah, just given a couple of your comments about democracy being imposed, just what do you think about the situation in, you know, in Iraq in, you know, 20 years' time, or Afghanistan, as opposed to, you know, had, you know, no decision been made to do what they did by the Americans?
Thank you. Hi, that was a very enlightening talk, and I agree with you that terrorism is a global phenomenon. But I think that terrorism as a concept is very relative and very diverse. Each it can be different in different contexts, and then some other times it's one party's terrorist, maybe a different party's freedom fighter, and that's one point I'd like to ask. And another thing is, in most cases, it's one country supporting, say, a terrorist group in another, within a domestic setup in another country for their own reasons. So what I'd like to ask you is, how far has the Madrid agenda tried to address this?
You mean the state sponsorship or support of terrorism?
Yes, yeah, state sponsorship of terrorism. And how do you generalize terrorism? I mean, it's pretty relative. Each country has a different, its manifestations are very different, and the issues which these terrorists bring up are also very different. So how can you generalize the term terrorist, and how do you put it on the global agenda and say this is terrorism?
Should we take more, or should we just answer these three and then take another lot?
What time does the hook come out?
We have to. I was hoping to finish at 2:15, but we can continue till 8 if we want.
Well, we can finish at 2:15, and then I can sort of hang around and loiter with intent if anybody wants.
Okay, so let's continue the questions then. We've got you, I know, because you've been waiting for ages. Yeah, and then the person in the blue shirt. Oh gosh, we've got hundreds. We'll try and be quick.
All right, I too am.
I've got to remind you all to introduce yourselves.
Oh, my name is David Sully. I'm a master student in political economy at LSE, and I am Canadian as well. And I am also interested in how we are conceptualizing terrorism, and in my mind, our responses to it are perhaps more significant than the underlying events. I think in terms of history, how this age, post 9/11 as we call it, will be judged, and at least its significance will be really not so much the certainly horrible events where I suppose in the West maybe 4,000 people have died as a result of terrorist attacks, but what it's justified, our responses to it, undermining human rights abroad, civil liberties at home, undermining multilateralism at the United Nations, disrupting the Atlantic Alliance, justifying preemptive unilateral world war. I mean, certainly it almost seems more like a speculative financial bubble where its value is not related to fundamentals, but in fact really to our irrational, exuberant responses to it. Thank you.
G. Leslie, extraordinary rendition, anti-terror legislation, corrupt members of the club. What is your position, that of the club, regarding extraordinary rendition? This is not just an obscene abuse of human rights and seemingly practiced by the US, but is an international crime in breach of the UN Convention, and hardly a way, surely, to combat terrorism, let alone to win hearts and minds. Similarly, what is your position, that of the clubs, on anti-terror legislation, viz. That of the UK and the Patriot Acts in the US, again, quite against human rights, and no, again, to win hearts and minds. And you mentioned earlier no members of the club who are corrupt. So what about Berlusconi? What about Chirac? Presumably they will never have any place in your club.
They are not members. But they're both in office also. So.
you had a question. What person behind you with that? Didn't you have a question? You didn't?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay, I missed. Okay, well then you're next.
My name is Ryan Bashek. I'm a MSc student here in Global History from California. I guess you could probably combine my answer with some of the other questions, and I'd be interested in getting both your response on this, concerning the use of military force and when it's justified, especially in a preemptive context, if ever, and then maybe think about a situation where a radical group, let's say for instance in Pakistan or in Palestine in the future, is fairly democratically elected by their people, and how the rest of the democratic civil world addresses a threat from a group that's coming to power by democratic means.
So that person at the back.
Yeah, hi, my name is Salah Khalil. I'm from Egypt, and I'm a master's student in political sociology. You know, one of the advantages of being at LSE is that we hear a lot of speakers and attend a lot of lectures, and yesterday there was one by Gary Young, who seemed to have completely different opinion to, you said, 67 presidents and prime ministers who came together and came up with this opinion of use of force against terrorism. And he seemed to actually suggest that wouldn't it be better to, especially for politicians, I mean, and ex-politicians, more than politicians, to suggest a political process rather than the use of force, which will only, I mean, it doesn't really address the issue right on. And the other point is looking more at the root cause through a political process. And if there is any injustice that could be a fertile ground for breeding terrorism. So I would appreciate the response to that. Thank you.
Now, how many more people do we have?
It's 22. Why don't I respond to these comments? In a quarter to, you can all flee to the door, and then I'm happy to, as I say, hang around.
That sounds good.
There were some sort of overlapping ones, too. With respect to using force, prevention, integration, you raised a comment about a politician here who had talked about against use of force. It was very clearly the view of the Madrid agenda that force was sometimes appropriate, but that it was that basically terrorism should be regarded as a law enforcement problem, kind of an almost a position of subsidiarity, that the lowest level of response possible should be the one that responds, because it's basically something that has to be dealt with at the community level. But the members were not prepared to rule out the use of force ever. But in terms of prevention, preventive war or whatever, oh sorry, no, that was you were talking about prevention of terrorism. But going back to the question of preventive, I mean, you can, you know, hypothesize all of these things. But I think there are clear international norms about engaging in conflict, you know, about whether there is imminent danger or not. And the problem with stretching it is that you often wind up finding out that you stretched it in the face of things that were not true. If the evidence isn't fairly clear, chances are, you know, it's not a good thing to engage in force. And I think that you know, Iraq is a very interesting example of that. There was a lot of haste to move ahead to engage in force in Iraq, and I think the problems are legion as a result of that. But I think it's also important to understand that there are times when force is important, and countries do have an obligation to protect their citizens. But again, if you go back to the view, when you ask the question at the back about rendition and all of this kind of stuff, again, the Madrid agenda was very clear because the consensus of all of our experts, all of our working groups, from those concerned with civil society, factors contributing to terrorism, military issues, intelligence issues, policing issues, there was no dissension about the importance of confronting terrorism within the context of the rule of law and respect for human rights. And again, it's both a moral and a practical imperative. And if you look at the problems that are coming back to haunt the United States now, you know, with people who thought that the president could exempt the United States from the Geneva Conventions, or people who were, you know, not clear in the leadership about torture and all these kinds of things. It comes back to haunt you. Terrorism is a form of psychological warfare. And those who are confronting it can feed into that sense of grievance if they abandon their own their own rules and values. So the Madrid agenda is absolutely clear on that. And you know, and I was very frustrated, you know, because in my role as defense minister, and also when I had the justice portfolio. I mean, there's a lot of literature on torture. You know, I'm on the International Advisory Board of the Center for Victims of Torture in Minneapolis. You know, this is one of the most documented human rights abuses. But it's very clear that as a mechanism for getting information, it has almost zero utility. You know, it's fun for people who are sadists and want to, you know, get vengeance on people. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't have utility for the people who do it, but it's not getting information. And it certainly isn't, you know, giving a country the high ground and a moral basis on which to actually, you know, gain international allies and cooperation and support for its cause. So, I mean, it's one of the dumber things that you can do. It doesn't mean you have to be friendly to everybody. You know, there's good cop, bad cop. There's all sorts of mechanisms for interrogation that are far short of torture. You know, where, you know, you're mean to people, but that's not the same as being tortured. Believe me, I know. I'm a politician. I've experienced both, and there is a difference. The first thing, the concept about that terrorism as a concept is very diverse. And again, that was something that's very clear in the Madrid agenda, which is that terrorism is not a unitary phenomenon, but there are many forms of terrorism. It has many different kinds of causes. And therefore, there's also a risk in sort of lumping everything together, that there are many different ways in which it manifests itself. You know, there are ways in which there are religious sources of terrorism, and incidentally, not simply Islam. I mean, there's lots of, you know, radical Christians in the United States, you know, and people, you know, who go out and, you know, shoot abortion doctors. Or there's a Timothy McVeigh, wasn't religious, but, you know, people who think the UN is trying to rule the world and, you know, America's been taken over by some, you know, evil, you know, powers. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why people do these terrible things, and so it's very important to factor them out and try to understand how people get radicalized, what are the mechanisms and what are the belief systems, and in those particular communities to figure out what the vulnerability is. Powerful belief systems, and religion is always a powerful belief system, are often useful tools, but no one religion has a monopoly on the ability to use that tool to radicalize people. Again, the question of conceptualizing terror and the definition of terror, again, this is probably something, and Mary and I may disagree on this, that it's probably the one area that's difficult for people to come together on is what is the definition of terrorism. The high-level panel that was that Kofi Annan created to advise him on various aspects of reform of the UN, the high-level panel that looked at security issues, came up with a definition of terrorism that said that terrorism is the victimization of civilians for political purpose, but it excluded actions done by state because that is divisive, and they said the international norms already deal with that. Excluding that from the term terrorism does not in any way legitimize it. It simply adds another category of violence by non-state actors against civilians. So you can say, boo, hiss, I don't like that, or you can say, as a practical matter, what the high-level panel has put forward makes it very clear that all of these things are unacceptable and against international norms. And if we accept their definition, and if everybody accepted it, maybe we'd be able to move on and create a convention. And there's been a Euro-Mediterranean meeting yesterday that issued a declaration that basically said the same thing, that basically endorsed that definition. But sometimes people say, you know, that if you don't include my thing in terrorism, then what you're doing is you're lowering the value or the evilness of what the states are doing. And, you know, that's not the case. The question is a semantic one. But at the end of the day, that's much less important than what you do about it. But if having that international convention would help in some way, in collaboration and coordination, then somebody has to give somewhere on the definition. And what we need is a leader who can persuade some of the followers to accept loss, in other words, to accept a definition which is not their optimal definition, but one which would enable the creation of some kind of international legal framework against terrorism to go ahead. I think And I think I addressed your question, of the root cause of processes, in the sense that there is no single dynamic of terrorism, and that each context has to be looked at. I mean, what's happening here? Why are people doing this? You know, why do they think it's acceptable? And how can you break down the acceptability of it in the community, too? Because when people think it's okay, then it's very hard to stop it. The final thing was the question about imposing democracy and raising the question of Iraq and Afghanistan. I think it's very difficult to impose democratic institutions. But I also think that when you have a situation we have in Iraq today, I didn't support the war in Iraq. And that, and, you know, £1.50 will buy me a latte today because it happened and it's there. Saddam Hussein has been deposed. There was a big mess there that has to be dealt with. How should it be dealt with? Well, a lot of people are trying to help the Iraqis create democratic institutions, but they will make up their own design. And whether they will succeed or not, I don't know. It is true that you cannot impose a democratic political culture, but I will say this. There is no example in history of a democratic political culture arising in a vacuum, that institutions are often out ahead of the beliefs of people. There are many examples of public opinion research being done in the United States that shows that a majority of Americans do not support the principles in the Bill of Rights. That they think that they're too, you know, if you describe them in a way that they don't recognize the language, that you have the same value, people say they don't support it. And so you're faced with this notion: how do you create the environment in which a democratic political culture has an opportunity even to develop? And as I say, it will not develop under authoritarian rule. There has never been an example when it develops in the absence of democratic institutions. The question is, when and under what circumstances can democratic institutions appear in a society that has, where they have a vague chance of surviving long enough to create the kind of cultural values that will support them? And I, for one, although I understand, I mean, looking at the history of my own society and my own culture, you know, Magna Carta was 1215. In 1215, King John had to, you know, allow the barons to encroach on his power. There's a long time between 1215 and 2005 in terms of the development of British parliamentary institutions, the erosion of the power of the king, the creation of the doctrine of equity, the development of the franchise, the creation of responsible government, etc. And in Canada, you know, we've had a long time to do this. But in this today's world, countries don't really have that much time, because in addition to the pressures on them, there is also the need for them to, in a globalized world, countries need to respond to the broader demands to interact on the basis of a rule of law with other countries. You know, if China wants to come into the WTO, China has to abide by certain kinds of rules, has to accept certain kinds of adjudicative processes. So it's not really possible for countries to be isolated and develop their own little institutions, you know, in isolation, as it was through the history of much of the existing strong democracies in the world today. So what is the balance? I don't know. I'm not a mind reader. I'm not a crystal ball reader. I'm not a psychic. I'm not a fortune teller. I don't have second sight. All I can say is that whatever the process is, it's going to be messy. It's going to be as messy as it was in other countries. There may be opportunities for countries to make quantum leaps, and maybe institutions will get out of the head of the development of a culture. I mean, I think about the former Soviet Union. I mean, one of the things that Marxist-Leninist rule did was break down all of the relationships of trust that we think are integral to a civil society. And the Constitution said the Communist Party is the leading organ of all life in the country. You couldn't form a stamp-collecting club without the approval of the party. Now, where does that leave you when all of a sudden you're trying to create a democracy and a civil society which is based on the notion that people need to be able to organize and communicate and trust each other and mobilize for purposes? I mean, in a society where this has been drummed out of you, it's hard enough in the Eastern European countries, but some of them have some recollection of a pre-Soviet culture. But in Russia, there's really nobody alive, except if they are, they're out of it, who remembers, you know, life there before the Bolshevik Revolution. So But the other thing is that I think that it's arrogant to assume that people will not be able to rise to the challenge. You have to give people a chance, and that's why, as I say, democracy can't be imported or exported, but it has to be supported. And to the extent that those who have lived with democratic institutions and understand how messy they are, but how they can function, can share that. And some people will be out ahead of the others. And maybe there will be leadership and institutions will be created that can survive long enough for people to develop an acceptance of them, an understanding of them, and a support of them. Then democracies can grow. But they're not going to grow in a vacuum. And we are now faced with a world where a lot of countries are facing the pressure of trying to make these institutions work and work in their own way. The other thing I'm just going to say is that it's also important to understand that there are ways in which traditional relationships of power, authority, can work consistent with democratic institutions. And I look at, I mean, you know, I live in a constitutional monarchy, as do you. And in fact, some of the most successful democracies are constitutional monarchies. A constitutional monarchy, a monarchy is a total anomaly. It's nuts. Why do we have people inheriting this kind of position? And maybe they'll, you know, go the way of the dodo. But if we're looking at some of these countries which are trying to create democratic institutions in a concept of very different forms of power structure, why don't we look at our own institutions and say, is there something about the role of chieftains, tribal chieftains in this country, that can be translated into part of the democratic system that can increase people's sense of commitment and comfort with the political society, while at the same time creating elected and accountable institutions that operate by the rule of law? We have to be creative. So it isn't a matter of going and saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. I mean, when I was at the LSA, they used to talk about the fact that the LSE had elected a lot of the elites in the former colonial countries in Africa, and that a lot of people left London thinking it was more important for a barrister to wear a wig than understanding how democracies really worked and how to translate the ideals of democracy into the realities of their own country. And that's why there are a lot of problems in those countries, because the Westminster system maybe doesn't work so easily in countries that have been formed of, you know, vastly diverse populations, you know, coming from a country in Britain where that wasn't a problem. So anyway, I don't want to ramble on, but just something to say that sometimes you have to deal with the reality that's there. You should do it in a way that understands that, yes, sometimes things take time. We don't always have all the time that we want to deal with these challenges. Don't underestimate people's ability to change, to learn, to grow. Don't assume that they're going to take forever, but understand that they're going to take longer than maybe you'd like them to, and find ways to support that process so that fragile institutions have a chance to take root in a society.
Well, thank you very much, Kim. I was going to add something, but I think we've come to the end. Chloe, you wanted to make an announcement.
Hey, I just wanted to say, as Mary mentioned, I'm carrying on working with Mary, trying to build a network and campaign of people from across the world who want to get engaged on debates on terrorism and the war on terror. At the moment, it's called Citizens Against Terror, which is quite a kind of scary title, and we might change it. But the reason for that really was because people are obviously concerned with terror as it's experienced as a result of state and non-state actors. And it's clear that people are concerned with the way the war on terror is being handled as much, perhaps, as terrorism. And we want to offer a forum and then a way of people coming together to do something about these issues. And if any of you would like to join the debate, then if you can write down the email, it's citizenscampaign@gmail.com, or email Mary maybe, and you can be part of this dialogue. Particularly, I'm working on linking students between Baghdad and London and Cairo and Delhi, hopefully, for a debate on the impact of terrorism and the war on terror on their lives and communities. So I'm looking for people from LSE to sort of run the London side of it. So if any of you are interested, then come and see me. I actually have to run, but email me.
Do we have your email, Chloe?
citizenscampaign@gmail.com. Thanks.
Well, thank you. Once again, I just want to say a big thank you to Kim. And I feel she was particularly inspiring on the subject of democracy and power. So I really hope you all take her advice.
Go for it.